Hi, my name is Lily. I'm the campaign director with Critical Resistance. I want to welcome everyone and thank you all for joining this call. We have some really exciting speakers lined up for the conversation. This is part of a quarterly series that CR holds for donors to the organization. We do this to offer special insight, thank you, reflection, analysis to those who support us as donors, as well as our members and people who are close to the organization. And so sometimes we have organizational participants and members who join the conversation. Sometimes we have some strong allies and leaders in movements we're partnered with, and that's part of what we're doing here today. So just to provide a little context for the call, CR, as with other organizations and movements, is in this moment of reflection right now that's moving to a different gear and since the post-election time. We really have been for the last couple of years in this moment of thinking about where do we stand in the context of liberal, bipartisan, across-the-aisle reforms to the prison industrial complex, be they body cameras, review boards, task forces on implicit bias, things of that nature, or lessening charges for quote-unquote nonviolent offenses. And so we started out the year that way, and now we're ending the year really on the flip side, sort of not assessing where we stand in terms of these across-the-aisle reformist efforts, but where we stand in regards to this bolstered racist alt-right movement that has certainly always existed in this country, but is more empowered currently through the government, financially, and among the grassroots. So we know that whether our targets are that liberal leadership or the neoconservative, some say, might say fascists in this moment, we're dedicated to shrinking the violent arms of the state, to fighting to revive, protect, and build the life-affirming resources that we need. CR does this work through campaigns and projects in our different chapter cities. We do that through putting up resistance to jail expansion and working for prison closure, as well as fighting militarized policing and developing community-based alternatives to address harm and crisis. And our work primarily in CR is rooted in the United States, but it's always been our mission to build an international movement to abolish the prison industrial complex. And in order to do that, we've collaborated with various third world and left groups in the U.S., and also build with organizers in other countries as opportunities arise, and really try to learn from and reflect on those struggles and strategies that are used in other countries. We know that the prison industrial complex, imprisonment, policing, are forms of state repression that exist and aid in bolstering imperialism, both in the U.S. As well as in other countries. And so we know that our resistance must also be global and internationalist in perspective. So that's part of what this call is about, to reflect on this current moment. And in doing so, offering some case studies from different speakers who are involved in organizing in different contexts within the U.S., who can really talk to us about any shifts, challenges, opportunities that they are seeing in this current political climate in regards to anti-imperialist organizing, how they're doing that their work locally that's challenging U.S. imperialism or connected to challenging U.S. imperialism globally, and then how those campaigns or stories or case studies that they're talking about can be used for models and used to really bolster and support anti-imperialist organizing and connection building between our movements, whether it be directly trying to hit at and dismantle the prison industrial complex or movements that are working towards liberation on other fronts. So what we're going to do today is we're going to have four speakers. We'll go one by one and have the speakers offer that case study, offer that story, offer a little snapshot of of their work and their organizing and how it relates to the current movement, moment and movements for anti-imperialism. And then after that 5 minutes, after we go through each speaker, we'll open up for a little bit of dialogue and question and answer, and that will be the time when we really also encourage people who are on the call to jump in. With that said, I hope that folks will put themselves on mute when they're not speaking so that we can all hear our powerful speakers. And also just so people know, if you're in a time crunch or on your lunch break at work or your breakfast break on the West Coast, that the call will be recorded so you can hear the rest of the discussion afterwards if you have to jump off, although we encourage you to participate. So with that, I will go ahead and kick it off. We are going to ask Charlene Carruthers to be the first speaker for us. Charlene is a Black queer feminist community organizer and a writer with over 10 years of experience in racial justice, feminist, and youth leadership development movement work. She currently serves as the national director of the Black Youth Project 100, an activist member-led organization of Black 18 to 35-year-olds dedicated to creating justice and freedom for all Black people. First politicized as an 18-year-old while studying abroad in South Africa, her passion for developing young leaders to build capacity within marginalized communities has led her to work on immigrant rights, economic justice, and civil rights campaigns nationwide. We're really fortunate to have Charlene both with us this morning, but also with us in this movement and standing alongside her as well. So thank you, Charlene, for kicking us off.
Great. Thank you so much for the opportunity and for the invitation. I'm finding myself in these conversations after Election Day quite often, and not always with the best of words. At the same time, I've been involved in a number of discussions and just heart-to-heart conversations about where do we go from here, with the recognition that, you know, what we're coming up against as we move into these next couple of years is not brand new. However, the opportunities, the work that we have to do perhaps has evolved, or there's a deeper sense of urgency. And so what we are focusing on in BYP 100, and for those of you who don't know, we're a national organization of young Black activists between the ages of 18 and 35. We have 7 chapters across the country and members all in between and all over the place. And we focus our work specifically around economic justice, policing, abolition, LGBTQ, and gender justice. And so what we are doing in this moment is really taking stock of what it is that we have to double down on as young Black people in this movement, and also how do we build relationships, stronger relationships, and alliances with organizations from across the movement. And so as we move into 2017 and beyond, we are focusing very strongly on political education, knowing that we have identified this moment in conversation with elders as a moment of neo-fascism, a rise of neo-fascism, and an opportunity for a neo-fascist state to entrench itself against our people. So we have to do deep study. Two, we have to engage in both defense and safety in a different way than we've had to do before, particularly about what does it look like to build safe zones or sanctuaries within our local communities. And three, for us, it's really about building those deeper relationships across Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. Because, you know, when we think about any project that's anti-imperialist, it requires us to relate to each other differently, relate to the land in which we live on differently, and think about how we are engaging with each other as a project, of course, of abolition, which requires us also to dream, envision, and create alternatives. And so our local chapters are diving into invest, divest work. We're diving into political education work, diving into building cross-movement relationships, and really even questioning some of the assumptions that we once held about the right, about the conservatives, and becoming much, much stronger and tighter in our rhetoric and our understanding of the situation. Because, like it or not, many of us misread what was happening in this election cycle, or didn't fully read what was happening, and now we are faced with the consequences of that. And the last thing I'll say is that what I believe, at least I'll say on my behalf, is that in addition to our opposition being the so-called alternative right, white supremacists, conservatives, our opposition is also found amongst liberals and progressives, particularly the mainstream established liberal and progressive organizations and groups. And so when we think about defining our opposition and what we're up against, we have to have a multi-tier strategy that not only confronts the white supremacist, white nationalist, so-called alt-right, and also looks at our opposition within the mainstream progressive and liberal establishment.
Thank you so much, Charlene. Yes, that last question is definitely on all of our minds as we see our movements pivoting also to move towards the defense that we know is so critical of our communities. But sometimes that defense is also coming in the hands of more liberal and moderate organizations. So thinking about what that means is very important for us as we move forward. So I want to, I didn't give the lineup, but let me do that really quickly before I introduce the next speaker. So next we're going to have Nadine Naber. And then we have an exciting substitution for Katie Joaquin. We're going to have a comrade named Bernadette Lauren join us, who will speak about some connected movements. They work closely together as comrades. And then we'll have Fahed Ahmed close us out towards the end with his presentation. So a little bit about Nadine. Excited to have her join this call. Nadine is an associate professor in gender and women's studies and global Asian studies and director of the New Arab American Cultural Center at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Nadine's research interests lie at the intersections of transnational feminisms, women of color, and queer of color theory, decolonizing feminisms, empire studies, critical race studies, and Middle East studies, as well as Arab American studies. Nadine is author of Arab America, Gender, Cultural Politics, and Activism, and she is based in Chicago and active with the Arab American Action Network and the Rasmia Oda Defense Campaign. And so in particular, we are also asking her to speak a little bit about what has been happening with the defense campaign for Rasmia Oda, who you'll hear about, and how that organizing is connected to global anti-imperialist work, as well as imperialist targeting. Just to remind people, please put yourselves on mute if you're not speaking, and I will go ahead and do that to myself as we bring Nadine on. Thanks, Nadine.
Thanks, Lily, and thanks to everyone for organizing this. I've been working with the Rasmia Oda Defense Committee, and Rasmia Oda is a Chicago-based Palestinian American, and she was arrested and then put on trial in November 2014 by the U.S. Department of Justice for allegedly lying on her naturalization application 10 years earlier when she did not indicate that the Israeli state arrested, convicted, and imprisoned her in 1969. So obviously when you see an immigration case based on documents filed more than 10 years ago, it's clear that this is a fishing expedition and the Department of Justice is using immigration as a political tool to target a Palestinian community leader. And we also know that this is obviously part of the systematic repression of activism in the U.S. supporting Palestinian liberation. And also it's important for thinking about anti-imperialist struggles that there is a direct connection between her immigration case and Israeli settler colonialism. So let me just break that down in terms of how her immigration case is directed to Israeli settler colonialism and U.S. support for the Zionist state. So So Israel targeted her over 40 years ago in 1969 in her homeland of Palestine. And at that time, the Israeli military had picked her up as part of a sweep of 500 Palestinians, which is common practice. When she was in detention, Rasmia was tortured, and she was sexually assaulted for 45 days into confessing to two bombings that killed two people and injured many people. So she was basically sexually tortured into a confession that she committed two bombings. So she spent 10 years in Israeli jail. She was released, and then she came to the U.S. in the mid-90s, and in Chicago, she built this Arab Women's Committee, which is a component of the Arab American Action Network. So she's been serving as a major force in our local community in Chicago as immigrant woman, as someone who serves the needs of hundreds of immigrant and refugee women, and also someone who has continued to fight for Palestinian liberation and, you know, has never given up that struggle. So when she was targeted in the U.S. in 2013, and then her trial was in 2014, during her trial, she was actually denied a fair trial, and the judge basically told her that her torture story, the fact that she was sexually tortured in Israel, was barred from the courtroom, but they allowed the prosecution to repeatedly refer to her as a bomber. So she was repeatedly referred to as a bomber, but she was not allowed to say that she was sexually tortured into confessing to that bombing. So she was denied her defense. And then she was convicted, and she spent a month in jail in solitary confinement. And her lawyers have played a major role, and our community and all the, you know, movement in support of her has challenged the conviction, and she was released, and she was granted a retrial. So this was a huge victory that we just learned of about 2 weeks ago, that she was granted a retrial for this coming January. So that meant that she was going to be allowed her defense, the defense that was denied. However, just yesterday night, that we received a huge blow. And this all is part of the post-election moment and the escalation of white supremacy and Zionist, you know, violence and state violence on all levels and racism. So we just got this news yesterday that U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid announced that a grand jury that she had impaneled returned a new superseding indictment against Rasmia for unlawful procurement of naturalization. So here is the escalation in the charges against her. So the new indictment adds two allegations that the crime she was forced by torture to confess are now being referred to as terrorist activity. And second, that she failed to report an alleged association with a quote-unquote designated terrorist organization. So basically what's happening now is the charges against her are being escalated from being a case of immigration fraud to now she will stand before the jury as a potential terrorist. Just want to pause for a second so listeners can just, you know, take in all that information. I think there are many issues important to anti-imperialist activism. First, that obviously the direct connection between immigration structures in the U.S., structures that target immigrants, and especially immigrant activists, the connection between that and U.S. militarism and U.S. empire building, and in this case, U.S. support for Israel. So 100 Israeli documents were used in her trial in 2014. These were documents from Rasmia's 1969 case in Israel. So 100 Israeli documents were central to the prosecution of Rasmia in the U.S. in 2014. And then it's also important that many activists have said that her case and her life story embodies the Palestinian struggle because her family was displaced in 1947. that was right around the creation of the State of Israel when her village was completely depopulated. But what's important for our movement here and now, in addition to that, is that her case teaches us about how U.S. imperialism and U.S. militarism and warmongering work within the United States through the targeting of activists here, and how essential the targeting of activists is in the United States to U.S. militarism and empire building. So I just want to add 2 points related to organizing. One is that I think there is a need for the growing BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, to think more about how to work in closer connection with the Palestinian, Muslim, and Arab grassroots communities that fall under attack when the BDS movement grows. So the more that BDS is successful, that the people who get targeted, you know, directly and really closely and intensely are Palestinian, Muslim, and Arab institutions, neighborhoods get put under surveillance, people get targeted for connections to terrorism. And so it's important for BDS activism to remain accountable to the grassroots communities that BDS is sort of representing or working for. And then the last point I want to make is about joint struggle. So I think in this post-election moment, the connections between, in terms of like how white supremacy and U.S. empire building works and impacts many communities, Black communities, Latino communities, Arab communities, et cetera, will become more and more obvious. So just if we think about the Sami Awadeh case and the case of Israel and the targeting of Palestinian activism, we already know that the U.S. has been providing military equipment and services to Israel in the form of firearms, assault weapons, and all that. And then that ends up coming back here to the United States when federal programs provide military equipment to police departments. And we saw that, of course, in Ferguson and turning especially working class Black communities into these war zones using war-grade firepower and all that. And so that's, I think, a really important site for thinking about how we can grow our connections in terms of joint struggle. We already know that U.S. trained police in Israel. We know that key resources are taken out of communities of color to fund Israel and the U.S. war machine. So we can just keep talking about, you know, what the structures are that force us and inspire us into connection so that we can connect these movements and connect the targeting of activists, the surveillance of activists, and the increasing, marking of activists as whether it's terrorists, violent criminals, or whatever else, all those pieces can connect and help us build broader coalitions and joint struggle in this new moment. Thank you.
Wow, thank you so much, Nadine. Some key points to you raise in terms of joint struggle, and I want to make space hopefully for us to all talk about that together with people who are joining us on the call after we wrap up with our presenters. So thank you. If I could just remind people to mute themselves, that would be great. So next up, we want to invite Bernadette Aloren to speak to us. Bernadette is the chairperson of the U.S. chapter of BION, or BION USA, which is an alliance of 20 Filipino organizations in the U.S. fighting for social and economic justice. She's also a member of the International Coordinating Committee of the International League of People Struggle and International Anti-Imperialist and Democratic Formation of over 300 groups in 6 continents. We at Critical Resistance, through our various chapters and in our national work, are in alliance with Filipino leftist organizations, and I can say personally, but also in the organizations that I've been involved with, that learned a lot in regards to just lessons of how strategies are so integrally, and politics and learning are so integrally connected through migration and through the forced migration economically and socially and militarily of Filipino people, and how folks have stayed connected to their movements and fights for liberation. So thank you, Bernadette, for jumping on this call, and excited for you to share more about the work that you're doing now and be in conversation.
Yes, thank you. I'll try to be succinct. So we were founded in 2005. We're an alliance, by the way. Bayan USA is an alliance. So we, as an organization, we are made up of 20 organizations who have their own, each of them have their own independence and initiative and program for the organization. So what we basically do is we're a campaign coordinating center for these organizations. So we were founded in 2005. That time, of course, was the war on terror was still raging on, and especially in the Philippines. The war on terror was also in the Philippines. It remains in the Philippines. The Philippines was declared the second front of the war on terror back in 2002. So that declaration had a big impact for Filipinos in the Philippines and here in the U.S. as well. Essentially, Bayan is a chapter of Bayan Philippines, which is a broad anti-imperialist formation with a membership. It's also an alliance. And essentially, it represents a national liberation struggle for the Philippines, a freedom from imperialism, foreign domination, and primarily U.S. imperialism. So what is our work? What have been our challenges here, been here in the U.S. since we were founded? So one of the big issues that we took up immediately, and we continue to take up, is the issue of war and militarism. Back then, the Philippine Revolutionary Movement was branded as a terrorist movement by the U.S. State Department, and that listing was renewed very recently this year. So that has also had an impact on our work because we are more or less red-baited as front for the Philippine Revolutionary Movement and therefore as fronting terrorist organizations in the Philippines. So with that type of condition, our work has been challenged a lot, but it hasn't stopped us. So with regards to war and militarism, our work has taken up, we joined coalitions, we've done a lot of education work, we've done lobbying to cut U.S. military aid to the Philippines, U.S. aid to the Philippine military. We've done solidarity missions to expose our friends here in the U.S. to U.S. military presence and also drone exercises in the Philippines. But the challenge for us has always been we're always confronted with these questions of, if we're in the U.S., why are we doing so much work for the Philippines when there's a crisis here in the U.S. as well? So that being said, that's been a big challenge for us. That being said, we have to assess our work because for our perspective is such that there's a global economic crisis that is endemic to imperialism. And that crisis involves war and severe exploitation of the working class. So what we've had to do is we've had to repackage, in a way, our work and really conduct more education work on neoliberalism, because it's hard for us to move forward and build more support for our anti-war, anti-militarism work if we're not really explaining a big chunk of this, which is the neoliberal aspect of this. So even in our work with anti-war groups here in the U.S., we were challenged with finding there was a lack of young people in the major anti-war formations here in the U.S. There's also a lack of representation of national liberation struggles in anti-war groups here in the U.S. So given that we're a coalition of mainly young people and we actually represent a living and thriving national liberation struggle, we have to also do our due diligence to also challenge our comrades in this work to expand it, you know, to even expand our knowledge of what war and militarism is, using our experience as the Filipino people, for example. So in assessing our work in realizing how we needed to conduct more education work on neoliberalism, not only for others but also for ourselves, so we could explain it well for others. We are now in the undergoing a very deep internal education campaign with our membership. We are also engaged in different areas of work that are in relation to neoliberalism and how it relates to the funneling of all public funds towards the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, and the financial-industrial complex in the U.S. So our students are engaged in a new campaign called Take Back Our Education, where they are fighting for a redirection of education funds away from the military-industrial complex and towards education, public education, and also fighting for installment of ethnic studies in campuses where there are huge populations of immigrants of color and immigrants who are and students who are immigrants. We're also with our workers. We have worker organizations. Our alliance. We're conducting self-defense workshops on what to do if you're confronted by a state, a state defense officer, whether it be ICE or a police person. We're also conducting education on the crisis itself and how the crisis is at the root of this whole wave of neo-fascism and xenophobia, which is not new. It's been happening all over Europe, recently. And it just landed now more overtly with the election of Trump, but it's always been there. It's a lot of work, but we're happy to do it. There's a lot of things happening in the Philippines right now because of the neoliberal economic policies that are now basically pushing for more trafficking, human trafficking or labor trafficking of Filipino migrant workers to the U.S. So we are actually in a moment right now where we're actually building new worker organizations of trafficking survivors. So, like when we first started, the War on Terror, the Patriot Act also meant that the Filipino workers in the U.S. Were also scapegoated because of the Patriot Act provisions. So back then we were able to build worker organizations because of that condition. Now we're in a moment where we're building more worker organizations because of increase in human trafficking of Filipino workers to the U.S. because of these neoliberal economic policies. So we are also organizing we're also part of the ILPS, or the National League of People Struggles, which is a broad anti-imperialist united front, like was introduced earlier, of about over 300 organizations from about 40 to 45 countries. So this ILPS is organizing an anti-war militarism gathering in Toronto next year in August, and we're part of organizing that as well. The reason why Toronto is because we want to be able to invite leaders from national liberation movements to also speak that would normally not be allowed to enter the U.S. or are banned from traveling to the U.S. So we really want to include their voices in the global discourse on war and militarism, particularly for U.S. peace and anti-war activists. So that's our work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bernadette. Not just for that presentation, but for all of that incredible work. I am particularly myself interested in talking about, and maybe we can go into this here or in another conversation about how we really build new structures and new organizational structures for meeting the challenges that we have right now and the shifting moment. And the way that the targeting and impacts on our communities are shifting and changing. So thank you. Appreciate that context and education. And so lastly, we're going to bring up Fahed Ahmed. Last but not least, it's exciting to have a powerful list of organizers on this call. Fahed came to the U.S. as an undocumented immigrant from Pakistan in 1991. He has been a grassroots organizer on the issues of racial profiling, immigrant justice, police accountability, and national security over the past 13 years. He's currently the executive director of DRUM, the South Asian Organizing Center in New York City. DRUM works to mobilize and build the leadership of thousands of low-income South Asian immigrants to lead social and policy change that impacts their own lives, whether that be immigrant rights to education reform, civil rights, and worker justice. Fahad is also a critical resistance community advisor. We're happy to have him on that advisory committee. And we're hoping Fahad could talk a little bit today about perhaps picking up from what some of our other speakers, Nadine and Bernadette, have talked about too, kind of immigrant rights and migrant rights within the context of imperialism and settler colonialism and how that looks for the work that you're doing on the ground in New York. So thanks, Fahad, for joining us and for being with us at CR and in this movement. You there, Fahad?
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute.
Cool. Thank you. And yeah, I think there's a couple people maybe who haven't been able to mute themselves. I believe if you push star six, if you can't do it on your phone, you should be able to mute yourself.
Right.
And go ahead, Fahad, if you can just speak up.
Okay. Yeah. Peace, folks. Thank you for having me on this call. I'm with a 2.5-year-old, so if you hear a noise in the background, please bear with me. As was mentioned, DRUM is a mass-based organization. We are an organization of working class South Asian immigrant workers and youth. Our members, sort of lead our work, make the decisions around the issues that impact them. And so I kind of want to talk about our immigrant rights work within the larger frameworks of imperialism, of militarization, of policing that other folks have been talking about. We are a multi-issue organization, but immigrant rights is probably like our largest program area. And so I think kind of the way that I wanted to frame this is just historically for us, but also particularly in the current moment, what does solidarity mean? And that question is just around, it's really around who are we building solidarity with? How are we building it? And like really, what does it look like? In flesh and blood, what does it look like? And so the way we frame, there's like different levels of solidarity. There's sort of kind of like stuff I could say on the call. It's nice and easy for me to say, like, I stand with Bernadette, I stand with Charlene. Like, that's easy to do. There's a second one, which is transformative, which is kind of like, all right, let's go mobilize, support those folks so that those folks can come support us when we need them. It's very kind of transactional. A third one is kind of a embodied solidarity in which like people kind of actually start putting their bodies on the line. And I think this is kind of what we see particularly activists in terms of like, people surrounding the police station, getting locked up, civil disobedience. And that's very important because that's kind of where really consciousness shifting happens. But the people engaging in it are people that are already kind of activists, are already politicized on their own. And then the fourth level is transformative solidarity, which actually doesn't look quite as flashy, but it's by people that are directly impacted. So it's like undocumented folks, it's women, it's poor folks, it's queer folks. And it's those people that are actually changing the direction of their own struggles. They are realigning their own struggles to be aligned with the struggles of other communities. And we call that transformative solidarity. Because what it's stressed to do is it undoes the contradictions that exist across our communities. A little bit about kind of how this happens, and then I'll share some examples. So for us, this happens through working with a mass base of people. And so for us, like this means like undocumented youth, cab drivers, women that work at home, restaurant workers, people who are not, they're not like activists on their own in our communities or in society at large. But they're coming and engaging with us largely because of their own bread and butter issues around immigration reform, around worker rights, around police accountability. like just everyday people. And with them, we're engaging in political education, relationship building with mass spaces of other organizations or other communities. So like actually meeting with, getting to know, you know, mothers who've lost their kids to police violence, immigrant mothers that have lost kids to the border militarization, and then engaging in joint struggle with those people. And really it's like these three components of political education, relationship building, and engaging in joint struggle, which we found moves people to a level of transformational solidarity. And so examples for us, what that's meant is our undocumented youths, you know, there's all these challenges that exist as a result of being undocumented. There was a lot of energy, you know, over the last 15 years at several moments around the DREAM Act, which would allow particularly undocumented youths to be able to get legalization and get papers. But one of the components of the DREAM Act is a military provision that you can get documents if you join the military. And for us, that's meant that, well, that means I could get papers by agreeing to go abroad and kill other people. At various moments, that's meant particularly Latin American countries. In the last 15 years, that's particularly meant actually some of our own South Asian, Arab, Middle Eastern countries. And so sort of like through the process of political education, relationship building, engaging in joint struggle, not only did our youths take a critical stance on the DREAM Act around the military provision, foregoing their own material self-interest. They would benefit from the DREAM Act, but foregoing that out of a position, a principal position that they arrived at through joint struggle with other people. So not only were our youth able to do that, but also other youth that our youth were engaging with in Latino communities, in Filipino communities, were able to arrive at some of those same positions. And for us, that's a manifestation of that transformational solidarity. Another example has been around the expansion, the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. Whenever you talk about immigration reform, you know, there are two communities that are essentially at the bottom in the hierarchy. Communities at the border, on both sides of the border, U.S.-Mexico border, and people that have, immigrants that have past convictions. And the immigrant rights movement constantly sort of throws those people underneath the bus. But for our members, because of the relationship building, because of the joint struggle with some of those same people, and some of those same people exist in our own membership, I've come to a place to where they will not accept a immigration reform proposal if it means increased militarization at the border, or if it means the criminalization, detention, and deportation of the people that have already been criminalized, in particular, Black immigrants, queer immigrants, immigrant workers, you know, who have to do what they have to do to survive, and are already doubly or triply targeted by a racist police and criminal injustice system. And then also, thirdly, I think as Bernadette mentioned, you know, this is also around tying into conversations and engagement around, like, well, why are we here in the U.S. in the first place? Why were we forced to leave our home countries in the first place? And talking about and understanding the global impacts of colonialism, of capitalism, of imperialism as the root causes of why we were forced to leave our homes in the first place. You know, we have similar sort of things around our other program areas, around policing, around educational justice. I think a very brief example I'll share is around educational justice and bullying. You know, we work on the school, ending the school-to-prison pipeline. We have youth that are impacted by the school-to-prison pipeline. But if you were to survey youth in our communities, they would say actually they're a lot more impacted by bullying. And in New York City, that bullying often actually comes at the hands of other youth of color, youth who are being criminalized through the school-to-prison pipeline. And so we have many organizations in our communities who say no to bullying, zero tolerance for bullying. And by asking for zero tolerance for bullying, what they actually end up asking is more police in schools, harsher discipline policies, and further perpetuating the school-to-prison pipeline. Instead of that, our youth have been engaged around, you know, through the relationship building, again, with youth in our own base, but also in the bases of other organizations, around, like, well, why does bullying happen in the first place? What are the structural things in place in school? How does the way the curriculum is structured, the way that the hierarchy in schools is structured, the way that there's no accountability for administrators and school officers when they engage in bullying with students? What kind of impact does that have on students and their relationships with each other? And then how do we, understanding this larger systemic forms of violence and bullying, which then manifest in smaller interpersonal ways, how do we actually bring about restorative justice-based solutions so that we don't further perpetrate the school-to-prison pipeline? And so I kind of wanted to share some of these examples, both for us to think about kind of what solidarity, kind of levels of solidarity, and in the context of opposing militarization, criminalization, the police state that exists all around us. And I think it's really this sort of relationship building and solidarity building which is going to be critical for us in the coming period. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Fahad. I think that's a great place for us to end the presentations as well. Just talking about that joint struggle and real transformative solidarity and I think that's part of having this call, not just to talk about the politics and the framing, but to really learn the strategies and share those strategies and connect those strategies to one another and hopefully move that through our organizations and our movements in the both prior to this call, but in the beyond. So I have a lot of questions myself, but I want to open it up to people on the call to join in, to share reflections or questions that you might have. I would ask that we keep it succinct. We're trying to wrap up this call. We have about 12 minutes left. So I would ask that people who want to jump in keep their comments or questions succinct so that we can also hear from our presenters. So thank you again to all of our presenters. Is there anyone who would like to jump in at this moment with a comment, reflection, or question? Well, until we hear from someone, one of the things that I had mentioned, I've been thinking, and people can jump in and just say, I'd like to be on SAC. We can get you in here. But in the meantime, one of the questions that's on my mind and has been on my mind, and I think that it's been discussed in terms of real political education and joint struggle, but one of the things that's been on my mind is, what are some concrete strategies and practices that your organizations use to stay connected to or take leadership from and build joint struggle within the international context? So really learning from movements internationally and how does that look for you and how do you build that leadership or have those conversations internationally or globally? Whether that's through migration or rooted in a context of long history of enslavement or genocide in this country that's connected internationally. So any particular strategies or practices that folks want to highlight?
Hi, this is Berna. So I mentioned earlier that that Biden USA is part of the International League of People Struggles, or the ILPS for short. And so the ILPS is an international formation, international anti-imperialist formation that gathers every 3 to 4 years. It's membership in a General Assembly. And during that gathering, there is intense meetings and sharing of information. So the last gathering was just last November in Manila, and the way each assembly is structured is that the ILPS is concerned principally about around 17 issues. So you can go on the website, but so for example, education, the Commission on Education and students met and did sharings on what each of these members of ILPS who are working on this issue are doing around the world. And so I think it's important that we actually meet in person, you know, and given that we don't have a lot of resources and those most impacted by imperialism are unable, don't have the resources, right, to travel internationally. So it's important that we go to them. It's important that we so those of us who are in the advanced industrialized countries, learn how to fundraise and go there ourselves and see for ourselves. Because nothing really replaces actual person-to-person contact and also seeing with your own eyes the conditions of those who are deeply impacted by imperialism, especially those who are impoverished. So I think it's important that we build these alliances like the ILPS, and we really work to develop them and enable them to be able to convene. And that requires fundraising skills and really utilizing and appreciating the technology that we have at our hands to be able to communicate across borders, across continents. So I think that's a lot of that work can be daunting, but it's very, very gratifying, especially when it's solidarity manifested in many ways, especially when you're able to speak with people who are coming from movements that normally wouldn't be able to be represented in the U.S., for example.
Thank you, Verna. Does anyone else want to chime in on that question? Or any members of the audience, callers on the line who would like to jump in?
Hi, this is Allison. I had a question for Charlene.
Great, thanks, Allison.
I was wondering, kind of at the end of what you were talking about, you said that you are questioning the assumptions about the right and about conservatives, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that, please.
Sure. So in my experiences in many less radical revolutionary spaces, people are oftentimes very dismissive of, we'll call people Twitter trolls or Facebook trolls or irrational or whatever that is, and not necessarily look at what people are saying. And I don't say this because I think we need to, like, reach mutual ground or just listen to each other or be in dialogue, but I think we actually have less tools in our toolkit, in our toolbox, when we don't pay attention to what the opposition or the enemy or however you frame them, what they're saying and what they're thinking. And so after the election, myself and a couple other folks, we spent some time just looking through Reddit and other websites and saw and noticed that the sentiments that people held were actually, we had quite a bit in common. But oftentimes the solutions are very different, and like who was responsible for creating those conditions, the understanding of that was very different. But the conflict or the problems, the tensions that existed, there were quite a few things that we share in common. And so I think we're much better equipped when we know how the opposition thinks and what the opposition says to actually pull the rug from underneath them and actually take away the power that they have. And so I think be it paying attention to the polls or assuming that, you know, this country wouldn't elect someone as ridiculous as the incoming regime as Donald Trump, and it did. And so even though I think, and these are generalizations that I'm making, it's not that I believe that everyone was made those assumptions, but I do believe that many people did.
Thanks, Charlene. I think one of the questions that was coming up for me in relation to this as folks were speaking is, you know, Charlene, you mentioned doing deep political education around neo-fascism, and then Berna mentioned doing deep political education around neoliberalism. And so so I think, you know, hearing about also from other speakers how we engage and how our organizations shift and we educate ourselves, given those different contexts or how we're figuring out, you know, what our opposition is looking like and how it's moving and shaping itself in this moment, be it fascistic or a hardening of neoliberalism. So I want to open up, too, for Fahed or Nadeem to come in on that question as well. Or any speakers, any participants, too, can chime in with that or any other questions, either clarifying or comments.
So I'll chime in just really quickly around political education and what I think is necessary. One.
You want to introduce yourself? I recognize that voice, but not everyone does.
This is Charlene.
Everybody has a different voice.
That's okay. Around political education, one, when we think about accessibility, just on this base level that the popular ed and the political ed we do should be multilingual. And that varies from community to community. But when we're talking about Black folks, like, are we translating our materials into Spanish and French? Thinking about our various immigrant communities. So on language. And then, you know, I'm not one to believe that our people don't understand so-called activism language. I do believe that we actually expect too little of our people or underestimate our people. So how do we use plain language in the ways in which we talk about these about the work that we're doing and these concepts or these ideas? Even saying ideas over concepts, how are we using plain language in the way that we do political education? I think those are my two things: language accessibility and making sure things are multilingual whenever possible.
Awesome, thank you, Charlene.
Mm-hmm. Hi, this is Berna. I will just also share a little bit about our practice in conducting political education, especially around neoliberalism. So because we're connected with so many movements around the world as well, it's a great resource for us to also to get information from them. Because those who can speak to neoliberalism the best are those who are impacted by it. So we're able to draw materials. And we also have to work on formatting them, you know. Once we receive them, we have to format them into educational materials for our constituency and for our allies here. But it's a lot of work. We actually have to develop our political education materials ourselves. So we get information through the alliances that we're a part of, through our allies around the world, and we're able to, because they already have their own materials, we just have to format them. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. What we're doing now is we're trying to develop more materials around the impact of neoliberal economic policies in the U.S., particularly around immigration, labor migration, as well as real estate development and zoning. So, you know, in relation to gentrification and displacement. So so that we can also relate them not only for our constituency here, but also inform our allies overseas on what's happening in the U.S., the impact of the global economic crisis in the U.S. as well.
Thanks, Berna. I want to, if Nadeem, if you're on the line, I want to invite you to chime in on that, too.
Okay, so on the question of political education, right?
Yeah, and what that's looking like, I think, in particular, in the work that you're doing and organizing,
sure.
In this moment, and then we'll just have Fahed round this out on this question and wrap up for the day.
Sounds good. So I can suggest three pieces for political education. The first is that I think more and more the way that Palestine organizing and solidarity is developing in the U.S. is that the focus is so much on the land of historic Palestine and activists from the U.S. being in solidarity with Palestinians in Palestine, which is crucial and central and definitely a priority. But what gets lost is that Palestinians don't just live in Palestine, especially if the Zionist project ultimate goal is to displace the indigenous people from the land, and you have over 7 million Palestinian refugees. More Palestinians live outside Palestine than in Palestine. And the Palestinian struggle itself exists all over the world. So in the United States, the Palestinian diaspora has historically always been part and parcel of the Palestinian liberation struggle. So the Palestinian diaspora, the Arab diaspora, are not solidarity movements. They are the Palestinian movement and the broader Arab liberation movement. And so I think there's a tendency to ignore building ties with grassroots organizations like AROC, the Arab Resource and Organizing. Sorry, Lily, help me. My brain just stopped.
Center.
Let's say in California, or the Arab American Action Network in Chicago. One of the reasons that's central is that we were just talking about a genealogist case. And the way that the Zionist movement works, and U.S. support for Zionism, is to intentionally cut off the Palestinian diaspora from Palestine. So one of the ways that the Palestinian movement gets crushed is by making it impossible for Palestinians in the diaspora to stay connected to Palestine through these laws and these lists like the foreign terrorist organizations. That list is there for a reason. It's there to make it impossible for Palestinians and others in the U.S. to work with Palestinian liberation movements in Palestine. And so that's part of how Tasnia has been targeted in this new phase of her case, is that she's being associated with a terrorist organization. So I think that it's really important for us to think globally and internationally and transnationally when we think about what we call the Palestinian movement or Palestinians or solidarity with Palestine. The other thing, I'll be really brief because I know I just talked a lot, I think we need to challenge the word Islamophobia and the way that the media and, just the dominant discourse out there is talking about Muslims and Muslim Americans. Because it's much more complicated than saying Muslims. There and even Islamophobia, if you just use that word, you end up thinking about religious discrimination. And what that does is it erases the context of U.S. imperialism and racism and white supremacy, and how Islamophobia is there to further the taking of land and the taking of oil and growing military power in the Arab region, in South Asia, in the Philippines, and all the places we've been talking about. And so the solution for Islamophobia, if you use the way it's being talked about in the media, would be policies to end religious discrimination. And I think that's really limited, and that's sort of what's been happening, is this like focus on Islamophobia versus calling it out as racism and white supremacy. And a perfect example of that is the Muslim registry that's being talked about over and over. A lot of people don't know that that registry is based on a Bush administration policy called the End Tiers, and the countries that with the people from a set of countries would be required to register. So it's not that you wouldn't be required to register based on your religion. You would be required to register based on your country of origin. So again, all of that gets lost when we just throw around these huge terms like Muslims, Islamophobia, and most of the countries on the list are Arab countries of origin, but they're not only Arab countries. And it's the same thing with, so anyway, I think we need to also think about how we define the sanctuary movement. How can we broaden it to from just a focus on deportation to also a focus on surveillance and a lot of these spying programs and programs like the CVE program that's there to make sure that communities spy on each other. So you can get a federal grant, a police department can get a federal grant to soak at a mosque or any other organization to spy on, you know, its people. So I think all of these policies need to be better understood, the post-911 policies that are potentially going to be resurrected. And then I think we need to integrate that education on those policies into the way we're talking about the sanctuary movement.
Yeah, we've been talking about that at CR too, is just also how we fit police militarism and daily police violence into conversations about sanctuary and police repression, not just sort of overt violence or physical violence. I just want to really quickly thank everyone. Sorry we don't have time for more commentary, but I think we heard from Fahed, from you a little bit more earlier on this question of political education. So I want to just respect folks' time and wrap up the call and thank all of our speakers, Charlene, for kicking us off with some important context around the organizing, Nadine for talking to us about the updates in Rasmia's case and how that's emblematic of anti-imperialist struggles, and Bernadette for your work connecting Filipino liberation struggles, as well as Fahed for sharing with us about, you know, how we can really have true transformative solidarity and joint struggle between our communities. And I think that we all know that we can't achieve liberation without that type of joint struggle and true solidarity. So thank you all so much for joining on this call and to our speakers, and look forward to continuing to work together as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. That was amazing.